It's HPR, All Things Considered, and I'm Dave Lawrence, saying aloha to a rock and roll legend and five-time guest, Bobby Weir of the Grateful Dead. And our farewell will go through the highlights, starting way back in the summer of 2001, live on the radio in Boston from the sunny backstage lawn at the Tweeter Center.
Bobby, it was like my first time that I ever saw you solo and outside of the Dead was right here at this venue. It was fall of 1989, and you and Rob Wasserman were doing a duo thing, opening for the Jerry Garcia Band. Jerry had an unusual guest out for several shows.
Oh, right. Clarence.
Yeah, Clarence showed up.
That was back, Clarence was living in the Bay Area, and Jerry was single at the time, and Clarence was trying to build a fire under Jerry to get them to, he wanted to move in with Jerry and to have a great big boss bachelor pad.
Oh man, that would have been trouble.
I think Jerry wisely declined.
How does your mind wrap around 1989 when you think back to it?
We hit a groove in 89. 89 was a good year for us.
One of the peaks?
Yeah, easy.
It takes dynamite to get me out. To bet you everything is just enough. One more thing, I just got to see. I need a miracle every day.
And it really was a miracle getting to sit down with Bobby again that day in July 2001 after that show at the Tweeter Center in the dressing room now, digging into a hallowed topic core to the Grateful Dead legacy and one rarely discussed.
The camping and vending scene. If you could reach back into your mind and tell me when you first noticed the camping thing evolve at the Dead shows.
I think it was in the early 80s that it started to really become something, achieve a substantial mass. It was way cool back then. We got away with it for a number of years. There wasn't trouble out there, and you know, if you were you, for instance, and a teenager, you could sort of run away from home, and it was like running off with the circus or something. You know, you could disappear into that world and not be heard from for a couple of years. You were untraceable, and it was its own little world with its own little intrigues and all that kind of stuff. But then it got a little too famous. A lot of people came there for the wrong reasons. The same kind of thing that sort of poisoned the summer of love. A lot of your ne'er-do-wells and roustabouts started horning in on the scene. It got kind of ugly, and there were riots and stuff like that, and got out of hand, and we couldn't do it anymore.
It was the summer of 89 that the last camping and vending occurred officially. A lot of people were sort of aware because the Dupree's Diamond News kept coming out with the little reminders from the band saying, look, guys, you got to get it together. We can't just have mayhem. Was it something that happened right after that tour where you guys had like a meeting? How did it actually happen that you said, you know what, this has to end? This unique, once-in-a-lifetime rock and roll experience has to finally end.
Yeah, it wasn't anything that we were particularly happy about, but it was made plain to us by the powers that be in the various places that if we were going to have camping, then we weren't welcome, because nobody wanted that. You know, we were attracting your trash and boogie crowd, and it just wasn't working for any of the people who have to live in those locales.
A lot of people don't even understand what that camping and vending thing was. And when I try to explain to them that you could leave school on spring break, spring of 88, I'm reliving in my head here, and go away for a week, follow the Dead, you could pull into the parking lot. The greatest part, Bobby, is you pulled into the parking lot, there were two gigantic flashing signs, okay, at Meadowlands. I remember this in my mind. One sign said day parking and an arrow. The other sign said overnight parking. And it's like, this is a rock concert at the Meadowlands, and I'm camping there for a week.
This much I do know is it would make a great movie. There are all the elements for intrigue, romance, whatever.
How much knowledge did you have at that point of exactly what was going on out there? Did you understand the volume of kids, the numbers, the sheer number of kids who were living on the road in the parking lots of your show?
I used to, every now and again, I'd don a disguise and go out there, and it was a lot of fun. I had great times out there.
In 89, you went out in disguise in the crowd?
Oh, yeah. Later. But oftentimes, toward the end, it was just to check out what was going wrong and see if anything could occur to me about how to set it straight. There was no setting it straight. But through most of the 80s, I was able to go out there in disguise once again, so no commotion was caused. and just be out there, and I had a great time.
Did you get any veggie burritos when you're out there?
You bet, all that kind of stuff.
On that subject, which we've talked about the camping now extensively, we never really talked about the vending, and there's something about the Grateful Dead spirit, the way you allowed this a massive amount of commerce, hundreds of thousands of dollars in business was being done in the parking lots, and the way I interpreted the rule, so to speak, the quote-unquote rule from the Dead was, as long as it didn't have our logo on it, go ahead, sell what you got to sell in the parking lot to get by.
That was pretty much it. With regard to our copyrighted material, you have to police your copyrights or lose them. That's the law. So we couldn't allow that to go on. Besides, by not allowing people to use stuff that we had copyrighted that had already been done, it spurred them to be creative, and that was good.
And you sort of, in the best of ways, let that happen.
Oh, sure, but it served us. It served the whole situation, the whole scene, if you will. It was mutually beneficial, symbiotic relationship. I had a great time.
Perhaps the reason that the Dead was able to become such a community was this book, and the book is Dead Base.
Oh, right.
I wanted to sort of have you describe what the Dead Base is.
Among other things, it's all the shows that we've done and all the tunes that we did, and commentaries.
Do you own a copy of this? Is this like sitting in your house?
Sure.
Do you use it as reference?
Well, I used to use it all the time. The updates I used to use to find out what tunes we did last time we were in a given town so we wouldn't repeat ourselves.
I have Dead Base 10 that Bobby and I are looking at right now on the table. Bobby's like flipping through.
It's a thick book.
You could kill a large cockroach with this thing. The book is filled with other artists that you guys have played along with. Mm-hmm. It's also filled with stories about important people in your lives, whether it's Neil Cassidy or whether it's musicians that you've jammed with. And when was the last time that Neil popped into your mind, Neil Cassidy?
I don't remember. My guess is...
How often do you think of him?
Often enough. I was probably telling somebody the story about how he taught me to drive, which I won't go into here. It's a little too long.
Sure.
But, he was a huge figure in my life.
I think a lot of people still look at On the Road and find a huge bond in it. It doesn't matter what generation you're from. Yeah. It's a very powerful thing. And the connection between that book, one of the main characters in it, and the Grateful Dead is something that is valuable.
You bet. The definitive movie, once again, has yet to be made on the subject of Neil Cassidy, but one of these days it will be.
What you are and what you're meant to be. Speaks his name, though you were born to be. Born to be Cassidy.
To borrow the title from Jack Kerouac's classic, we went on the road to Worcester, Mass. In September 2001. Recording a Bobby Weir and Rat Dog concert for a radio special that would also include this intermission conversation.
You're one of the few Western artists who's actually played in Egypt,
uh-huh.
September 14th through 16th of 1978. What was the genesis of that journey?
Well, we had just always sort of said to ourselves, what would it be like to play, at the Great Pyramids? Finally, we just said, hey, let's just go and do it. John Scher, who was one of our promoters at the time, and also Bill Graham, sort of came together and got us over there. It was at that time a monstrous undertaking.
Sure.
Just getting power out to the stage. They don't have generators and stuff like that. They do a light show at the Pyramid, but they had nothing that would be required to put on a rock and roll show. So we had to get it there, and we had to get it working. It was interesting. I mean, in order to call out of the country, at least in 78, you had to make a reservation with the phone company to call out like 2 or 3 days in advance. And then maybe it had happened. And other stuff. And at least at that point, nothing worked particularly smoothly. Getting out of the Cairo airport, landing was no problem. You'd come in and they'd get your bags off the plane, and then you were pretty much on your own getting them from there. But getting back onto the plane and out of the country presented logistical challenges that not a whole lot of those folks were up to. Just the ticketing process. You'd be amazed at how much red tape and bureaucratic stuff that goes on and how little these people are cultured to do this. It makes any hassle that you've ever had with any airline pale.
By comparison.
Vastly by comparison. Yeah.
wrapping up our salute, it was in 2004 when someone you know had migrated here at the station before HPR, when Bobby shared a cool story relating to this song in what would be the final time connecting with the Grateful Dead's Bob Weir.
There was a 1970 train ride through Canada, and on this, you and Janis Joplin together learned this Kris Kristofferson song.
Yeah, from this guy, I think he was a writer from Kansas, and he knew the tune. He was, I think, in the country car. You know, we had the blues car, the rock and roll car, and the country car on this train. All of it was being recorded. I just saw the movie last night that they made of this train trip.
Festival Express.
Yeah. That little session that you just described wasn't filmed, but it was recorded, and it's part of the soundtrack. Basically, Janis and I, and I think there were a couple other people singing as well. I didn't remember that until I heard the tune. There was somebody else singing, I don't know who. Well, we got to the end of the tune, we weren't done, so we started la-di-da-ing it. And I think I started yodeling and stuff like that. And anyway, that so the end, that end little business on, that's how that end little business on Bobby McGee, that I guess now has been become sort of a standard way to do it. That's how that all started.
Is there a live era that is a personal favorite?
I think the last few years with Brent, the band was particularly hot. I think that was like the late 80s, early 90s.
Wow.
In good shape, and Brent wasn't in great shape, but he was real good.
I Will Take You Home, was that the one?
Mm-hmm.
And that was written for his daughters, right?
Yeah.
Do you have any contact with his kids? Or?
They're living in Hawaii now.
Say again?
They're living in Hawaii now.
Brent Midland's kids are living in Hawaii.
Yeah.
Where I am.
And his wife is remarried, and, you know, they're doing pretty well, I think.
Wow.
Graduated high school.
That's amazing.
Or is graduating high school this year.
Dig it. Here in Hawaii.
Yeah.
And as we depart here and wrap this up with you, of course, well wishes. I hope that the tour goes great for you guys, and it is a treat to speak with you again.
All right. Thank you.
Hi, it's Bobby Weir from the Grateful Dead and now Rap Dog, and you're in good hands with my buddy Dave Lawrence. We'll be right back.
'cause it just might be your kind of zoo. I can't think of a place that's more perfect for a person as perfect as you. And it's not like I'm leaving you lonely, 'cause I won't know where to begin. But I know that you'll think of me only. Please tell me.